Hello there. Apologies for arriving late to my own event. So, let's see. Let's wait a little bit before we kick this off. I think this is going to be a very, very intense and valid conversation because there's so much at stake. Nobody wants to see any nuclear escalation. But there's some serious concern as to why we should pay attention to this and see what we can do to reduce that risk. Let's see. Sam, anything interesting we need to know that's happened today before we start talking about the rationale as to how the escalation of cyber warfare is taking place? Anything that's happening today that we should know of, that you can think of, that you can share with us?
Well, not today, but there are two important topics, two important things which happened since our last room, last week. Yep. And one of them is quite important. It's the fact that there was a cyber attack launched on the Ukraine's power grid, on electrical grid. Mm-hmm. And it was obvious that the intention of this attack was to shut down the electricity grid in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And the way how it was done is that the Russian cyber attackers created customized malicious software, which was intended to disconnect high voltage substations, which belong to Ukrainian power company. And Ukraine's computer emergency response team, it's the organization which defends against foreign hackers, said that there was the idea of attackers involved in decommissioning several infrastructure elements of the power grid. And the way how it was done is that the malicious software bomb was basically set to digitally detonate last Friday. And that bomb consisted of so-called wiper malware. And the idea of that malware that it will delete all files on the computers that it infects. And in this case, they will be computers which are responsible for controlling Ukraine's power grid. What is interesting that such malware has previously been used by Russia. But this is thought to be the very first time since the February invasion into Ukraine where this malware has been used against critical infrastructure. So that is the cyber news for today.
Yeah, that's a very, that's a very important development, and it fits right at the core of why we're having this conversation, when we talk about the escalation of cyber warfare and geopolitical cyber warfare. When we talk about attacking critical national infrastructure, we need to be mindful that the attacks are not on the facilities themselves only, or the bricks and mortars of what a CNI is. It's in the way the damaging critical national infrastructure impacts people's daily lives and their livelihoods. That aspect must be at the core of the problem and the threat to critical national infrastructure CNI, because in the way it impacts people's lives, livelihoods, and the daily function of civilians. Now, when you're talking about the power grid, you're talking about millions of people affected, not having electricity, not having water or clean water, basics. This is an escalation. So when we talk about an escalation of cyber war and geopolitical cyber warfare, it's no longer the remit of attacking military targets. You know, now we're allowing, we're seeing the damage and the destruction to civilians. And that is an escalation. And with cyber, that means that parties who are involved on both sides have no reason to actually hold back if they can actually use this as a defensive mechanism or an offensive mechanism. And that in itself becomes an escalation. Something else, since now we're kicking it off and we've got more people joining. Sam, if you recall also to the audience, we also had another session. We talked about how the Australian government was considering passing a law that would allow cyber attacks to take place in help of the to help the Ukrainian cyber warfare, and for people from anywhere supporting mercenaries, whatever, they can do this in their support from anywhere in the world, including, and this is what the Ukrainian government was considering, including them being able to go into the local embassy or consulate of the Ukraine in the country where those consulates and embassies are, and be able to do their cyber attacks, being protected by the jurisdiction of being in an embassy. So that's also an escalation. When you add all of that, and that means the other side could do the same thing, volunteers can do the same thing. That is also a concern. If we go back now Sam, would you do us a favor, please? Could you at least, let's read aloud the synopsis of the session so we can put it into the right context. Sam, can you hear me?
Yeah, one second.
Yeah, please, thank you.
I'm just trying to find it because it's not on my screen at the moment.
Okay. If you don't have it in front of you, I have it in front of me. I can read it out myself.
Yeah, I think that would be better.
Sure. Well, the title of this session, by the way, is Has Russia-Ukraine Cyber War Escalation Raised Nuclear Risk? And the synopsis of what we try to address here is, has the exponential escalation of cyber war in the Russia-Ukraine conflict increased the risk of nuclear confrontation? The geopolitical cyber warfare has intensified and is altering the global geopolitical landscape, affecting sovereignties for years to come. This is also impacting the world's economic and political world order by challenging the interest and special interest of empires. The death and suffering of innocent people continue, while claims and counterclaims by both sides of how just their cause and actions are. Meanwhile, and this is critical, by the way, meanwhile, peace talks have reached a dead end. With all involved parties, especially the US, West and allies on one side, and Russia, China and allies on the other, seeking to improve their strategic battleground position to influence the outcome of any negotiated ceasefire. How real is the risk of nuclear confrontation by design or miscalculation? That's the question we want to address. And there's something else I will also want to add to this. Just like I was very descriptive in addressing, when we talk about critical national infrastructure, we need to recognize it is not about the bricks and mortars of the infrastructure, it's about what it does to people's lives. So when you attack CNI, you're really trying to impact and damage people's daily lives. Nuclear is the same thing, but for many who might think this is that nuclear question is really a technical question, I want to challenge you in a positive way. If you look at the United States, if you look at Russia, and you look at who has the ultimate decision on whether a nuclear missile is launched or a nuclear war is launched, and that is in the hand of the commander-in-chief in the US, which is the president, which is a political position. So, same thing in Russia, same thing in many other countries. It is in the hand of the top commander-in-chief, who is a politician. So, while nuclear is very technical, and the warfare of nuclear confrontation, blah, 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 all of that is very technical, the decision to go into it is political. And therefore, we need to address how we could, first of all, we want to address the risk of that happening, by design or by accident, and it is because it's a political decision, not just a technical decision. So, and incidentally, while we're talking about this, we want to address the cyber warfare, the escalation on these matters, and and why the negotiations have reached a dead end, because if we can have a ceasefire, this could help significantly in reducing the risks of further confrontation, cyber, military, or nuclear. So, and by the way, anybody who wants to add their two cents or their intervention to this debate and this conversation, please do so. And if you have a certain expertise in the matter we're talking about, please, at the beginning, explain what your expertise is and what you're adding, so at least it becomes more than just an opinion, but also because it's an expert opinion. Guta, what would you like to add to what we have just started, please?
I think the situation is a bit alarming when we think that we came to that point, right? When things could have diplomatic been avoided if there were politic will for so. That's my addition to it. I still completely shocked and, you know, with how things developed, you know, since, especially after the fall of Kabul, and, you know, we've seen how Putin was just bringing the troops, and then the diplomatic efforts in December that didn't happen. So it's quite disturbing, the whole thing, and we wonder who that war serves to, right? Because it's clear the list that it's serving is to the Ukrainian people, and even to the Russian people, who is going to take off part of the pain because of what the Russian government is doing. And I think it's important to remark that this is the Russian government war, not the Russian people.
You know, Guta, I think many of us are absolutely horrified at what we're witnessing in terms of the human suffering. But I also would agree with you. There are many people who would agree with it, that this all of this could have been prevented. It was preventable. And anybody who wants, and by the way, this is not taking sides or validating anybody's just cause. No just cause is acceptable when the death and destruction of people happens. But I do not see this as purely one side is at fault. I think we have in the West been poking the Russian bear and threatening their national security for longer than 15 to 20 years. This is not new. And in fact, we've already had numerous sessions where we talked about where I believe the US has been disingenuous in labeling as if they had no hand in all this. We could have given Russia that sense of national security that any nation needs to have, especially a superpower, that would have prevented all this. But we heightened the rhetoric. We threatened, we told Russia we're going to have Ukraine be part of NATO. And to Russia, this means that the likelihood of being attacked again or invaded again, just like Napoleon did, just like Hitler did, is very, very real. And to expect them not to respond, that's not right, you know, and that's not a justification for the invasion. But there's not just one single party responsible for these horrors. And I think the West has significant blame to take, the US to a large extent. And also, what I'm fascinated by is the silence of Germany and France at the prospect of the elevation of the new Nazis in Ukraine's before the war, and especially since the war. They used to be blacklisted prevented from being acting on, let's say, social media like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Guess what? They're all now operational on many of these platforms. It's alarming. But for France and Germany, this is on your back, on your doorstep. Why don't you say something about this? And this is happening under the watchful eye of Zelensky and Ukrainian government. This is also not acceptable. Just like we don't accept the Russian invasion and the horrors of the human suffering, we also have to say this is also not right. So I'm fascinated by, if anybody has any opinion on this, what you're thinking, how this needs to be addressed, because Ukraine is becoming is turning into a failed state where only extremists are able to operate, whether they're extremist neo-Nazis or even the ISIS fighters that have been now transported and now operating in Ukraine, on Ukrainian territory. This is the breeding ground for extremism of the utmost scary scale. And anybody who thinks this Pandora's box could be, you could put a lid on it again out of when you want to, that's so wrong. Look what happened to Syria. 10, 11 years of death and destruction because of the of throwing that extremist element on the ground. So this is very, very concerning. But it also goes to the heart of the escalation of the conflict in all its format: battleground, cyber, geopolitics, and now the risk of nuclear confrontation. It's really fascinating to me why not enough is being done, and I truly believe there can be something that can be done. One, for example, why isn't the US willing to concede making Ukraine a neutral country? I believe if that is offered and it's on the table, the war, the ceasefire could take place. Why isn't that happening? I may be mistaken, by the way, maybe there's some other issues, but I think the fundamental here is making sure that Ukraine is no longer a threat to the NATO's nuclear arsenal, not being a threat from the Ukraine onto Russia. If that can be assured, I think that would be that we could go very far from towards achieving this. Gutta, please let everybody in the room, if anybody wants to have an intervention, you want to add something to this, we'll open the conversation.
And Sam can bring them up, and we, you know, but to be honest, I think that the time to make this neutral corridor, let's say from Finland all the way to Ukraine, it has passed. Now it becomes a matter of sort of veranity and identity. I think the Ukrainians now are fighting for much more. They are fighting to be themselves, to exist. And that's why I don't believe they want to be a neutral ground anymore. I think they want to be part of Europe. They want to be part of NATO. And especially after that invasion, more than ever, they are going to want this. So I think we lost the momentum to create this neutral.
Let's say the buffer. I think that's a very valid point. But here's an interesting aspect. Historically, we've learned, and many of us who have researched this know that Ukrainian society is sort of like split along the middle by being, you have one half of the country that's pro-Russian, who speak Russian, and they associate themselves with Russia, and you have the others that don't. So I don't know whether we could say with any definitive level that it's if a referendum is made tomorrow whether they would want to continue the war or fight or they want to be with or against Russia, whether it's going to be unanimous. The country has always been split halfway or along those lines by being those who associate with Russia and those who don't. So how would you modify your assessment with that in mind? And would you, Guta?
Honestly, I don't know. I don't see it happen because you have the will of the people, right? If, you know, it's and should prevail.
No, I get you. Will of the people, but the people are already split, sort of like halfway through in the middle between some who are pro-Russia and some who are not. My point here is, would that be a deterrent in any peace talks on the Russia on the Ukrainian side? Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is there are that group of population that consider themselves Russians, and I think that's what on the two independent by Moscow province, right? The Donbas region there. Yes, they had two passports and things like that, but they are not the majority of the Ukrainians, right? I think the best bet there is that those two provinces would stay as independent states or part of Russia and a bit like Crimea, which at the end of the day, I think it's what Putin just wanted. I don't think he wanted more than that if he wasn't being put it against the wall in December. And I think the Ukrainians will not give in to become again another satellite state of Moscow. And why should they? On this one, I don't think so. I think that the best case scenario would be then this, lose this to province to maintain sovereignty and national identity, right? But neutrality, don't think so.
Well, if I recall correctly, Zelensky, President Zelensky, make the gesture, and I think this was a couple of weeks ago, please correct me if I'm mistaken on the dates, but President Zelensky did mention at one time that he's willing to consider Ukrainian neutrality as part of the peace, what's called the ceasefire and the peace accord. Did I not read that correctly, anybody there? So he was willing to put that on the table.
He was, but the others behind the wall were not.
So, wait a second. So that tells me those who are advising or influencing President Zelensky to accept or not accept are not necessarily the people, that people are sitting in shelters and are afraid of the bombs. It's the power brokers. It's the NATO allies and the West. Am I not correct? Would you not say so? I'm not aware that Zelensky went and talked to the Ukrainians. He's making the political decision as a president, which is fair. But the point here is, since he publicly mentioned this, we can always say it's either a sincere gesture or a smokescreen. But the truth of the matter, it did not go far when it came to the negotiating table. The bottom line here is he did publicly say that, and that means we have to take him for his word that this was on consideration. Maybe it came with a lot of different, terms and conditions. Let me put it this way. Sam, can you please take the audience into more of what transcended when we had one of the escalations in the cyber war about the Australian government considering passing laws? And also the Ukrainian government possibly allowing their consulate and embassies to be able to be used by other people to conduct cyber attacks on Russia. Could you do that, please?
This was quite a while ago now. And what is interesting about it is, of course, quite an unprecedented move. Australia was probably the first country considering the situation, and basically they said that if anyone who is Australia's citizen, they have the skills to do cyber attacks, of course, which is illegal in Australia, they were considering changes to the cyber security law, which would allow them to perform these attacks in the war scenario. Of course, this news came at the same time when Ukrainian government, as you know, the Ukrainian digital minister has created so-called Ukraine IT cyber army, which is a channel on Telegram, where I think over 300,000 people have now been invited and given tasks to perform cyber attacks against various Russian ministries and government agencies and other targets What we were reading is that Ukraine was actually ready to invite people to walk into Ukrainian embassies and consulates all around the world to basically launch cyber attacks legally, because the only way you can do it is if you are inside the embassy. In terms of the other news as well, Kalitos, as we discussed this topic, I know you're going to expand on the embassy situation. There's another very interesting and unprecedented piece of cyber news, which is related to the hacking from the Ukraine side, because obviously we are in a state of cyber war, and we just discussed at the beginning of this room the fact that there was an attack coming from Russia onto Ukraine's power grid, but the response was that apparently the infamous anonymous hacking group, they hacked Russia's government and Ministry of Defense service, and they leaked personal data of 120,000 Russian soldiers which are currently fighting in Ukraine. And the details which were leaked and available to anyone in the world currently to download, that included the dates of birth, names of the soldiers, their home addresses, and even their passport numbers. And after this leak was announced, the anonymous hacking collective announced that the reason why they did it is because they believe that all soldiers participating in the invasion of Ukraine should be subjected to a war crime tribunal. I'm going to share the link about this piece of news in a minute.
Yes, and yeah, carry on, Sam.
No, I think that is basically the two bits of news that we need to discuss, which is of course cyber related, and of course how it is going to affect the real life world and real people.
Well, this is why we want to discuss those, although we addressed them in the past, but from a different context. We addressed them from what they stand for, what they do. This is also showcasing the trend that we are seeing through the cyber war and what we label as the geopolitical cyber warfare, that now nothing is sacred when it comes to cyber attacks with motivation to damage, destroy, destruct anything to do with people's lives. For example, the information you just shared with the group, the disclosure of the private details of soldiers, that also means that those soldiers are now having to worry about their families going back home, whether they will travel. It's sort of like making nobody immune. But by the same token, if we're going to do that to the soldiers, let's assume you believe that's right. Let's go with that. Why don't we do the same thing to those who are giving the orders of invasions? So yes, Putin ordered the invasion of Ukraine, but the U.S. also invaded Afghanistan. The U.S. invaded Iraq. The U.S. I mean, there's so many countries that are doing so much. I personally believe if we want to use this trend, why don't we go after those who are actually, why aren't we going after those who are making those decisions? You know, not necessarily just as foot soldiers. And if you believe that's the right thing to do, maybe we should make everybody accountable, and maybe nobody will fire a bullet in the front ever again, and then maybe we'll have a much safer society. The fascinating part here is this is a trend, and the trend is saying nothing is immune, nothing is red line. We will hit wherever we can, if we can cause death and destructions, or we can actually attack the privacy of a soldier or the privacy of a minister and make sure he has to worry about his family or what. Guess what? We will do that. That tells me to some people a nuclear confrontation is not off limits. It's not a red line. To many of us who know or believe the nuclear confrontation is an unacceptable consequence under any circumstances. What I'm seeing so far, and please, anybody wants to challenge me on this, please go ahead. What I'm seeing so far here is the trend is showcasing us that nothing is off limits by both sides or both sides' supporters. And therefore, how likely is the risk of nuclear confrontation by design or by accident? And that tells me the risk is very high, because the decision to go nuclear is a political decision, not a military decision. And with what I'm seeing so far, it means the risk is getting higher, and I don't like it. I really don't like it. Guta, you want to have anything to say to share on this, please?
No, at the moment I've said what I thought. I'm curious to see, like, we have Ben and Kay in the stage with us.
Let's see. Sam, before you step out, do you have anything to add to what we're just talking about? And the escalation from what's now becoming there's no red lines. How worried are you from the escalation of cyber?
Of course, I can
see from the security perspective and the cyber attacks, and I can see that the escalation is happening, and every day there are new attacks. And while, for example, things like power grid attacks, they are not new. This kind of stuff happened before, but the fact that it's happening now during the real war, this kind of attack brings a completely different perspective, because it's a one thing when, you know, there is no military conflict on the ground, completely different thing that there is an ongoing military conflict. But of course, the new and unprecedented attacks happening every day, and I think that's the fact that there was a cyber attack very successful in terms of getting the personal data of soldiers on the ground. That is an unprecedented move by itself. And of course, the fact that it is now leaked and it's available, and the fact that it was Russian government servers which were breached, I think this is probably unprecedented, because we've seen other countries being targeted for this kind of attacks. We've seen companies, Khalid, right? I think you talked previously about the Marriott hotel chain breach, which obviously had similar consequences, but this is now soldiers on the ground. So,
right.
So this is just new in the past week, in the past few days. This is fresh since Sunday. And obviously last week we talked about our other attacks, and every single week when we run this room, there are more and more new types of cyber attacks, and cyber war keeps escalating, and there are new types of attacks which are being attempted on both sides.
And would you agree with my one of my conclusions that observations is that we're seeing now, when it comes to cyber attacks, that nothing is off limits.
Exactly.
Nothing is off limits.
If we're all in agreement that this, it's appearing that it's escalating and nothing is off limits, it means there's some people who think nothing is off limits, and that is why I sort of get to the conclusion that it's elevating the risk of nuclear confrontation. That everybody knows the horrific element of that. Guta, if you'd like to bringing the
we have Ben.
Right. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I have to say that I disagree with Khaled. I've heard him before. I think that there, I don't know, I just, it means being wrong. All of his assumptions seem to be wrong. You only need one person to have no red line. You only need one. You're making the assumption you need two. You keep on bringing up the West. The West has all sorts of problems. There are things that they've done in the past and the present that aren't great, but that's not the point. The point is, this is not a problem right now with Russia. This is a problem with Putin. I believe it. This is my assumption that if Putin wasn't there, we would be able to have some level of being able to. Putin's the problem here. He is the point of danger. Putin is, and Putin has no red line. So there is no red line. If you think that he can be manipulated, he will blow himself up.
Ben, if I may ask you, and this is first of all, thank you for the intervention.
Well,
and
you're putting all this criticism on the West, which is exactly what he wants to hear.
Well, I'm
this
sorry.
Is a this is a psychological. Let me do my point. This is a psychological war, and by you criticizing the West at this time, you are making him. You're feeding into his propaganda. You're making him feel good. This isn't about what the West is doing. This is about Putin. And what you need to do is you need to put so much pressure on Putin that he'll crack and the people around him will take him down. That's all we can do.
But let me just ask you specifically. First of all, I am happy to have somebody disagree with what I'm saying. That's fine. I welcome that. But if somebody's going to say to me, you disagree with me, I would ask you to specifically identify what is it you disagree with me. And secondly,
all right.
I'm not taking Putin's side, and I speak from experience of what my country, the United States, has done in the past that actually leads me to believe that they also have partial responsibility to this. So I can validate this. Now, you believe it's Putin who is at the core and the only reason. I respect that, and I'm happy to hear it, and that's fine. But I also am aware that my government, the champion of democracy, is the one that was involved in the PRISM, the PRISM, and the surveillance of citizens and people all over the world, including our partners, in the name of fighting global terrorism. So this is totally contrary. And by the way, we were spying on our own American citizens as well, not just on foreigners, and we were spying on our partners. And Angela Merkel's phone being hacked and listened to to try and thwart the risk of ISIS is not necessarily the way you do things. So I am justified in calling my country and Western nations into account, because we need to hold them into account. That is not a justification for what Putin did. So let me be crystal clear on that.
All right,
but
so I have an answer to that if you like. Tell me when you're done, I'll give you an answer.
Please, if you have, of course, please do.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It's the right stuff at the wrong time. It's the wrong time to be discussing this. I agree with much of the stuff that you said. Do it later, not now. It has nothing. If you do it now, you're taking stuff that can and should be taken care of later. They need to be accountable at some time later. But don't do it now, because when you do it now, you're making it. You're giving it. If you do it now, you're feeding into Putin's propaganda. You just don't do it now. Do it later. Nobody disagrees with you. Don't do it now.
Here, I respect your opinion that it needs to be done at a different time. However, respectfully, I disagree, and I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why for the benefit of this constructive debate. Because I also want us, the West, to be held to a much higher level of accountability so that we can regain some credibility and some level of trust by our own citizens. The fact, if I only challenge, because the way you're suggesting that I time it just to challenge what Putin is doing, it becomes inadvertently a consent that what my government is doing is 100% right, and it is not. Case in point, Western media, and this is something I believe in, it's validated. Case in point, Western media, since the invasion took place, especially the Foxes and the CNNs in the US, have labeled the invasion as unprovoked. I put in quotation, unprovoked. That is actually not correct. We have provoked. We, the West, have provoked. So we cannot say it's unprovoked. Now, if, in your opinion, it needs to be mentioned nothing from what we are doing wrong, and just only focus on what he's doing wrong, I respect that. I disagree. I think for the value of authenticity and for the value of credibility of what our arguments stand for, we need to be equally fair and condemning of all who are making mistakes and identify where they make the mistakes. Russia and Putin are wrong in the invasion. We are 100% in agreement on that. The US is wrong and the West is wrong in provoking Russia's national security. Both of those are wrong.
All right, but look, you have, I can hear you, I hear you. But you have a disease that you don't even know that you have. You have the disease of extreme false equivalency. Extreme false equivalency. Yes, the West does bad stuff. Yes, Putin does bad stuff. But Putin does genocide. Putin is killing innocent people. Putin wants to destroy a culture. Putin is using chemical weapons. Putin is going to use nuclear weapons. It's apples and oranges.
Ben, let me take you for a second. You called it a disease, and I laugh at that. Thank you for calling it a disease. That's fine.
Well, no, you do.
The false equivalency, again, with all due respect.
You don't respect me.
I'm sorry? Say that again?
All right, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm respectful of your opinion. I don't know you from Adam.
Right.
I respect your opinion. All
right.
And I want to keep this conversation constructive. But here's the thing.
All right.
If we're going to talk about Putin committing genocide, and let's assume this is true, we also have committed genocide. The invasion of Iraq, Ben, you need to listen, please. We invaded Iraq on false pretenses, and we didn't even apologize for it. And guess what? More than 1 million Iraqis died. So let's not talk about disease of false equivalency. We are responsible for that. And guess what? Those who have actually launched those wars, they don't even say sorry. They say, well, you know, it had to happen. Saddam had to be removed. The truth of the matter here is nobody is clean as Mother Teresa. So in my humble and professional opinion, credibility for the argument needs to be when it's actually appropriate on all involved sides and for what they've done wrong. So by condemning the invasion of Ukraine, we also need to say that the position of the West is not holier than thou. The West has intentionally provoked and the West has committed genocide, and all genocide and all acts of war crime have to be put where they belong and investigated, and those responsible. But we're only hearing about one side. What happened to the Palestinians, my friend? They've been living under occupation for 75 years. Nobody's paying attention to them. When they rise against occupation, which is a right, their human right for self-determination, nobody's talking about them. We talk about the rights.
Here's what's funny about this conversation.
Yes.
This is curious, respectfully. You and I probably agree on everything that you just said. I agree on, except that I have actually been working against the Iraq War. I have protested. I have spent a lot of time. I am in all those groups. I agree with everything that you said in terms of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I disagree with you 100%. Is the equivalency in the time of doing it. It's the fact of the matter is it's not the same. It needs to be taken care of. There needs to be accountability. We have been doing it for years. For you to say that it hasn't been brought up, CNN doesn't talk about it. Oh, what have I been doing for the last 20 years? I have been on the left doing activist left politics for 20 years. I've been on the side. I've spent the time. I've spent the money. I've done it. So don't tell me that everybody is ignoring it. They haven't been ignoring it. Have we succeeded in getting accountability? No. We still need to get accountability. But right now, we are just in a five alarm fire, stage five cancer. There's something going on right now in real time that has to be taken care of.
Absolutely.
The way of taking care of it is not to bring up other stuff.
Absolutely. Well, listen,
what
first
about
of all,
it?
It's good.
One thing by itself will take care of the other stuff later.
Okay. At least from a person who has the disease of moral equivalency, I accept that we would disagree on the timing. That's fine. You know, no two people need to have the same opinion. At least we agree on the fundamentals that.
When you agree on the fundamentals.
That's a very, in my opinion, that's a constructive thing. So at least we're disagreeing on whether we, for my disease that you labeled, maybe
yeah.
instead of taking two ibuprofens every 4 hours, I'll take two ibuprofens every 6 hours. I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you for your comment, Ben. Who next, Gutal, we need to bring in?
We have Kai. And then after Andrew and William.
Thank you. Kay or Kai, please, the floor is yours.
Kay is the name. Just a short possible observation, and I might have gotten it wrong. I felt that there was a bit of a jump from seeing that these cyber attacks are increasing, and then going to this definition of a red line, and then to the jump of we're increasing our risks, and I was wondering if you could explain that jump to me, so that I would understand how you came to that conclusion.
Happy to. Okay. Did you get the chance to join from the beginning, or did you join a bit late?
Yeah. Yep. I've been here from the beginning.
Okay. So maybe I wasn't clear enough. The escalation. We actually labeled it the exponential escalation of cyber attacks and cyber warfare, and the point we have reached now where critical national infrastructure are being attacked, which impact people's lives and livelihoods, and that now is escalated to a point where, even with the action of Anonymous, you heard the update from Sam of leaking the information, the personal information of Russian soldiers on the ground, which, by the way, other sides could do the same thing. But the bottom line here is, all of that escalation. It leads us to the conclusion from the cyber angle, which is from an expertise point of view here, is these perpetrators are saying nothing is a red line. Nothing is a red line. And the fact that now no such red line exists in cyber warfare leads us to the conclusion is that also increasing the risk of a nuclear confrontation? Because when the moment people who are perpetrating or are actually inciting such action that takes no consideration about humans, especially for what we've seen in cyber, these people are capable of saying, who gives a damn if a million people die from nuclear, it increases the risk. And we want to put it to the debate here. Who feels that this risk of nuclear confrontation is increasing, or maybe it's not increasing? I personally believe the advent of no red line in cyber is increasing nuclear confrontation by accident or by design. What that number is, I don't know, but it makes me wonder and it makes me worry, and that's why I'm putting it out there in the public domain so it becomes part of the consciousness, because we don't want to see that happen. We don't want it. I hope that explains the progression
there. Okay. Okay. Based on because there's more attacks, you feel it's a logical conclusion that we've increased the risk. We don't know exactly how much of a risk there's been increased, but you'd agree we've had this fear has been with us really since the 40s, that there is this risk. Do you think that there needs to be something like a Geneva Convention type agreement around cyber warfare?
You're asking, this is exactly where I'm leading to. And in fact, if I may just alter something you said, for better clarification, it's not that we're seeing an increase in cyber activity or cyber attacks. It's the increase that are giving us the indication that hackers see no red lines. Anything and everything is fair target. That in itself is the red light. The red flag. The red flag. It's the fact that these cyber hackers are looking at any vulnerability to exploit, and it does not matter who it impacts, especially CNI or civilians or whatever. That escalation is a new trend, because in the past what we used to see is cyber attacks predominantly financial motivation, geopoly cyber attacks that we label as political, ideological, religious, but they also have a goal in mind, which is either to coerce the nation states into taking a position, and these were all absent of an actual war taking place. This particular situation that we have with the Ukraine war is there's an actual war taking place, and the cyber war is a parallel. Just like 150 years ago, they used to have the cavalry and then the infantry and all that stuff. Now we have cyber. But cyber is far, far more profound. And the key here is the new level that no red light exists. No red line exists. That tells me that those who are perpetrating them or those behind them may be willing to say, well, so far, so what? Nuclear. You know, and that's why, and I, the conversation itself lends itself to say, well, how do we prevent this? So maybe a treaty on cyber is clearly necessary. How soon can we get one in place? I don't know, but this is definitely a step in the right direction, and it needs to be done on a much more urgent timescale.
Thank you. Okay,
you're
okay, yes? So, Andrew, hello, how are you? Welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad the focus is back on the cyber wars aspect. I was a little thrown off by, as Ben was talking about, some of the more strange tactics of whataboutism related to somehow Israel-Palestine conflict got involved. But it's true that while America has certainly a history of ill-considered enacted actions around the world, that has little to do, if not nothing to do, with this conflict, and especially about a possible terrorism coming from, or cyber war escalation coming from Russia. So my question is, because I recently joined the room, is there a professional expectation that the cyber war, the increase in the cyber attacks, will legitimately increase the danger of any kind of nuclear attacks by Russia, certainly not by the United States? Thank you.
Khaled? Your mic still closed?
Andrew, I think you raise a very good point, and we ended up on other things because Ben challenged the timing, that this is not the time to challenge the West. I disagreed. I think we need to challenge everybody. And at the core, from my argument, was we've challenged the West and some of what our governments have done for the last 20, 30 years, and we really haven't made much of a dent. So so that's a separate issue. We ended up with other things. But your point is the same question that Kay asked, to see the link. I make the argument that I'm concerned that while everybody is thinking in terms of the traditional warfare of the war between and the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, there's the other components taking place, and they are just as threatening. So the cyber warfare is very threatening. The fact that now cyber attacks are showing indications that the hackers are have no considerations for people's lives and livelihoods by attacking critical national infrastructure and things that impact people's day-to-day lives leads me to the conclusion. And if you want to really make it official, I'm speaking from a professional point of view. This is what we do. But can I say to you that the certainty of a nuclear confrontation rises from X number to this X number? The answer is no. But has the risk increased? And the answer is yes. By how much? I don't know. And I hope I'm wrong. The fundamental I also talked about here is there's two components to the nuclear confrontation and the risk of it and how to hopefully we can prevent it. Is the decision to go nuclear by any party starts with a political decision. It's not a technical or a warfare decision, because the final decision maker, for example, in the US is the president. In Russia, it's the president there as well. So these are political decisions to start with. I'm just fearful of this, and that's why I'm making the awareness of it, because not enough is being addressed, and it could take us into the abyss. That's basically my the rationale why I wanted to have this conversation. The trend in cyber warfare is a clear indicator we're heading in that direction, and I'm looking at how we can find ways to stop it getting in that direction. Thank you, Andrew. Oh, sorry, Andrew, you want to add
I just wanted to thank you for that. But I was reading the link above, thank you. My question was more specifically, what about what's going on do you feel is ratcheting up the threat you feel is growing? Like, more specifically, what are the acts that are taken or precursor events you feel that have taken place that you feel is ratcheting up this danger?
There are many, and we don't have all the time to discuss all of them on this call, but I think, I don't know if you joined the call from the beginning, but Sam came in and he brought in numerous examples, and there are links that have been put into the chat here in the room. Feel free to look at them. There are some specifics. And if you joined a bit late, by all means, the replay will be able to go and address those, and we'll address them in great depth and great detail, Andrew, if you joined a bit late.
Cheers. Thank you.
Yeah, with pleasure. Gutta, anybody next, please?
William. Welcome, William. Nice having you here on stage.
Hello, William, and thank you. The floor is yours, please.
Thank you for inviting me up. My name is William Gordon. I live in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. As far as I can tell, the cyber war has been ongoing for well over a decade. In the last couple of years, we had cyber attacks from probably, because it's hard to tell 100% where they come from, because I'm not an expert in the art of cyber warfare, but from what I have learned, we had cyber attacks from Russia that took out a pipeline on the East Coast, which supplied our gas, and it infiltrated it with something that caused a denial of service, so that had to be restored. We had a cyber attack on the Philadelphia Court of General Jurisdiction, which is called the Court of Common Pleas of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, First Judicial District. And that's basically the Philadelphia County Court of Common Pleas. And we couldn't file papers or get access to conduct legal business for about 6 weeks. We had to go back to using paper, which is probably a good exercise, and it's good to have that practice as a backup plan. Yep. But it's something that was an act of cyber warfare against our city and our state. We've had other cyber warfare acts where there have been massive infiltrations of private businesses, and the malware is still in there, and they're still figuring out how to get rid of the malware, and the FBI is dealing with that, and other government agencies are dealing with that. And while I don't trust government agencies completely, I'll tell you that in relationship to trusting other types of government agencies, I trust them more than, say, the Russian GRU or the Russian FSB or the Russian government. I trust them more than Bashar al-Assad or the government in Korea, who has conducted cyber warfare, probably for petty personal reasons against Sony Entertainment.
Yep, absolutely.
There's been a lot of cyber warfare going on, and it's not going to end anytime soon, and it's not in our control. As far as red lines are concerned, I believe that just because you or I don't know about red lines, and maybe you know about things more than me, but just because, as far as I can tell, we don't know about red lines doesn't mean that they don't exist. There are, I think, red lines in place where there are some threats and counter-threats, agreements or non-agreements that are going on where, for example, our water system could be at risk, our electrical grid can be at risk. A lot of critical infrastructure can be at risk. And that is a double-edged sword, because if we attack them, they'll attack us. And for the most part, that hasn't happened. So if I've got to trust one government over another, if I've got to trust my government over the GRU, FSB, Putin government, or my government over Mr. Kim's government, I'm gonna have to have more trust in what we're doing, and hopefully whatever that's being done is being complied legally within the FISA courts, so that we have our own legal process complied with, and absent proof that it's really being abused, then that's something I have to have some confidence in. But we are under attack, and I really think that that we should not necessarily accelerate the attack, but we do need to respond to it, and that's in the hands of our elected officials, and there's not much more than we can do than to have good elected officials. I'm not sure what other remedies we really have. But I heard about the problem, and I would like to see us not accelerate the problem. But if it comes to that, I'm going to trust that my government will take appropriate steps along with our NATO allies and other governments that are true allies.
William, first of all, thank you very much for the intervention. And there's a lot in what you said that I agree with. In fact, when you describe that the cyber warfare has been ongoing for the last 10 years, let me just add to that. The cyber warfare has been going on for almost 20 years. In fact, the geopoly cyber warfare, which is not just financial, but political, ideological, religious, it's geopoly cyber is a term we at MLI created. I created this more than 10 years ago. This has been going on for more than 12 years now. And in fact, to validate much of what you just said earlier on, when you mentioned certain cyber attacks that have actually debilitated the functions of certain cities, I talk about this in extensive details. It's well researched in my upcoming book, Survivability. Gutta, if you have the link, you can post it there. The book is coming out in a matter of a few weeks. Please go ahead, look at the synopsis of the book. You can register for updates. This is not a marketing for the book. The last thing I'm worried about or I care about is sales. This is really a conduit to creating awareness at the level of top decision makers and the general public. And I actually go into so much detail about how so many cities and countries that have been impacted by not just cyber attacks, but geopolitical cyber attacks. Case in point, many in the audience would have heard about the rift that took place between Saudi Arabia and Qatar 4 or 5 years ago. Many people don't realize that rift that ended up turning brother against brother and a blockade of Qatar that lasted for a number of years started with a cyber attack on their information ministry, and the hackers attributed words to the ruler to say something that he didn't say. And within hours, there was a condemnation by Saudi Arabia and UAE of Qatar and the ruler. And they asked him to apologize. Of course, his pride was, I never said any of that. And why would I apologize if I didn't say it? Literally within days, Qatar was blockaded. This is brother against brother. And the cyber attack clearly was a premeditation for all of the ongoing activities to take place. So what you're saying, William, is so true. And this is what we need to be mindful of. So it's not just the escalation of cyber attacks, it's the motivation and the fact that some people who are perpetrating these acts or are the conduits of these acts by other people, puppeteers or whatever you want to call them, these people do not care about humans and others. And that's where it really raises the concern for me and why we're talking about this trend could lead to the escalation. The other thing is that you mentioned, which I totally agree with, is we need to have some level of trust in our public officials. Although my trust, I would like to have my trust in my public officials to be 100%. But let's call it for whatever it is. You know, if any of us have been in a relationship and, you know, our partner cheat on us once, or they disappoint us once, cheat on us once, you give them a chance. Twice, you give them another chance. We got kids in the balance. But if they keep on lying to you repeatedly, your trust is very, very challenged. And here's the thing. I can't compare, let's say, a partner that is cheating on me with the partner of somebody else who lives on the 5,000 miles away. That means, but their partner is better than you. I have to deal with what I have to deal with, which means I have to deal with those who I am responsible to and they who are responsible to me. So to a large extent, because we live in a democratic society, and because our rules and laws and our liberties are enshrined by law and by constitution, we are in a position to hold our public officials better accountable than many other countries. So I don't expect the North Korean to be able really to hold Mr. Kim to a much higher account, because they probably won't survive till the next morning. So in that aspect, it is us who live in the West, especially those of us who live in the US, where we have these amazing laws and constitutions that give us those rights. We need to use them better so that we can hold our public officials to a better account and do it better than we have been in the past. So on this one, I totally agree with you, William, and that's the challenge for us. And why I'm bringing these debates to the general consciousness is I want to make sure that people are aware that it's not just about a cyber attack, it's about some of these people who are doing what they're doing, whoever their side is, have no qualms about who they hurt. One last point to address that you mentioned, William, which I think you would probably see value in this. When, let's use the example of Russia or China or the US, when, let's say, Russia and China start cyber attacking each other, both sides know to some level of degree when they are being attacked by the other party. In attribution, in cyber, anybody that tells you they know 100% it is that side, they're lying to you. They're not. They don't really have to add other evidence to corroborate what they're coming up with to lead to a conclusion of some certainty, but it's not, we're never 100% certainty. But just use the example of two main players like China and the US hacking each other. Both parties know it is in their best interest not to allow it to escalate, because both parties know there are other means to to utilize that could be of damaging to them. So the U.S. will say, you know, you keep on hacking me, I'm going to put some freaking sanctions on you that, you know, your head will spin. So China would say, okay, fine, you know, let's not do this. The problem is when you have self-motivated individuals or individual groups that are not responsible to these governments. There are some that are responsible who work on their behalf. We know about this. But let's assume you have a jihadist or a terrorist or group or some other group who are not responsible. These people have little leverage on them so that you could actually force them to act in somewhat of a responsible way, because they have to fear what happens next. They have no nation, they have no accounts or bank accounts you could freeze. So what can you hold against them? This is what actually worries me equally from cyber. On the nuclear part requires the nation state itself to actually make that decision. And I pray to God that they know what's right and what's wrong and never to engage in that. But on the cyber stuff, an individual who is self-motivated or brainwashed can do a lot of damage, and we have no leverage on them. That's my two cents on this. Guta, I think Richard is next in line to speak.
Yes, we'd like to thank. Hi, Richard, how are you?
Hi, Guta, thank you, and pleasure to be back.
Thanks for coming again, and the subject is, as always, intriguing. So the floor is yours.
Khaled's so right. There are so many, I heard that China has 1.5 million private actors. They're not directly paid or on the state payroll, but they act in the state's varied interests, and they are many, and they're more innovative because they can pivot more quickly than the central leadership can. So as long as they assist and abet the state, that's fine. And I suspect Russia has some ecosystem of similar, so they can, you know, that's like using Wagner and private enterprises and contractors and temps, you know, the same tactics that private industry uses to wash its hands of culpability is what governments can use in this new battlefield. So that's all I have to affirm on Khaled's.
Thank you, Richard. And in fact, for example, let's use that number of 1.5 million of these Russian hackers. Chinese hackers.
They're actually not just hackers, but they're also like, you know, reposters, commenters, content generators, all sorts.
They're also the what we call the purposed disinformation army, and that's under which false narratives, fake news, all of these things fall under. So it's not just hackers, you're absolutely right. But the fundamental point here is, if, for example, you know, the two presidents of the US and China sit together and say, look, you know, we can't continue doing this, we have to find a way. And let's say they shake hands and say, okay, we gotta tone it down. Well, guess what? From the Chinese side, you could expect maybe the Chinese president to say to his lieutenants, say, okay, tone it down, and then the 1.5 million will need to follow the line, because it may not be Chinese employee at Chinese government officially, but they're contractors. But you know, in the US, you know, we are the private-led model of the world. Everything's private-led. So guess what? It's the same thing. Nothing changes. The same thing would happen. But both sides now can influence and control what their extended arm can do. The problem I find is with those who, and now with technology, the advance of technology and the ability of an individual to be able to shut down a city or a country, and I talk about it in my book because it has happened. This means that the threat of geopolicyber war impacting nation states, people, critical national infrastructure by small groups or individuals that we have no leverage on is very real. Very, very real. And we need to be mindful, and we need to adapt our posture beyond just cybersecurity, which cannot mitigate all these risks. So in that sense, Richard, you make a very, very valid point. Thank you for affirming this. And then let's keep a vigilant eye, and let's create the awareness that we need to have
a form of a treaty of some sort at an urgent level to deal with this. The cyberspace cannot remain the OK Corral with gunslingers left, right, and center. Cannot. We cannot afford this as a humanity. Gutta, who else do we have?
You are five people. You can do a bit of popcorn if people feel like it. And I would like on this one that you just said to bring how we can organize, an international set of laws to regulate the cyberspace, how it's going to be, and the sovereignty inside the cyberspace as well, and national security, how that's going to be extended, because now it's a new border as well.
Well, you know, Gutai, this is exactly right. The thing here is, and Ben may not like what I'm going to tell him, what I'm going to say to the public, to the group here is, and in public, is it was Russia in 2017, I believe, or 2018, who proposed to the United States of having some kind of a cyber treaty. And the United States sort of like shrugged it off. And there's a reason why I think the US shrugged it off, because we felt that we have the upper hand. Why would we negotiate with you? We have more money and more resources than you have. So why would we want to do a treaty? But then two, three years later, we're recognizing that there is parity despite the advantage, economic or technological advantage of one side. There is parity, and so many people, and no country is immune from damage. That's the key point. So I really think maybe people with goodwill will prevail, so that a cyber treaty of some form to start with, that could really, at least to start with, minimize the escalation of risk.
Where would be the jurisdiction? And after that, there's William as well, who just opened his...
Ask a question again, Gutta? I didn't hear
you. I was wondering where would be the jurisdiction for the cyberspace rules and courts and things like that.
I think you're jumping the gun. I think before we get to jurisdiction and courts and enforcement, all that stuff, which may take 5 to 7 years if the two parties shook hands today on, yeah, let's do something, and we are interested. The bureaucracy of it all, and I've witnessed many treaties by the UN take shape and form, and I've witnessed, for example, GDPR, the 10 years before it became law by the EU. These things take a long time. What can be done with a rather fast turnaround is a simple format would be a building block. A simple format, if you treat it as an MOU, a memorandum of understanding of some form, but it would have a bit more teeth on it, that both countries, for example, it could be Russia and the US, it could be the US and China, would say, we, the undersigned, proclaim here that we will cease, we will do this, we will only act in defense. If ever a cyber attack is perpetrated on us, we will reach out to you and we ask for your help in determining who the perpetrators are. And I think one of the key components, and I've seen this in negotiating or previous treaties, is that if you can make the other side, who is an adversary, a collaborator or a helper in helping you identify how to identify who did this or how to mitigate it, it goes a long way to building trust. So, for example, if the US identifies facilities or infrastructures are being attacked, and let's say there is this treaty, this MOU with, let's say, China, they can reach out to their counterparts, you know, and the counterparts, by the way, believe it or not, in many instances, non-politicians, counterparts do work well with each other. So they can reach out, by the way, we're having this, do you know about anything about this? Well, let's find out. Maybe they can shed more light. It builds trust and collaboration, and that's what I would start with. Something very simple, it creates a new trend of collaboration. It allows us to build trust with each other.
that maybe in a year, 2 years, and but what it does is it at least addresses the escalation and hopefully stops the escalation. That's what I would propose. That's what I would suggest. And I'm sure, by the way, this is like a simple format. This is the many areas, but we cannot just wait for a full treaty. Those take half a decade or a decade to be formulated and agreed upon.
Right. We win.
You raise a lot of good points, and I would assume that if, for example, the United States and Russia an agreement, not even necessarily a formal treaty, but something where there can be checks to see if it's being complied with,
correct,
that useful thing. But I assume that within Russia, within St. Petersburg and Moscow and most of Russia, that the cybercrime is either at the direction of or with the blessing of Vladimir Putin, so that being an authoritarian ruler, he can rein it in. He's probably already getting a cut. So that would address something like that. But when you mention jihadists, who may be non-state actors that are not under control of a sovereign government, I'm not sure how a treaty can be helpful unless you believe that the state actors with whom you have a treaty have some leverage over the jihadists, and I don't know if that...
That's a very good point. Very good point, William. And I use the term jihadists, and I actually wanted to use many other forms. It's not just jihadists because it's a label. But you're absolutely right.
Good example.
Absolutely. The key point here of that label is that those who are truly self-motivated, and there's plenty of them today, as you already know. But the proposal I had, or the idea of what could be formulated with a relatively decent speed, applies to how nation states can actually start creating some form of trust, so that we don't allow either the escalation of cyber warfare. We prevent the escalation of cyber warfare, which then reduces the risk of nuclear confrontation. The other stuff, those individuals who we have no control over, that's a different problem that we have to deal with. At least nuclear confrontation, as it stands now, is only going to take place if a nation state that has it is going to launch it or retaliate to it. So what I propose would address that. The other part of the individuals, there's another angle, but that's for a different conversation at a different time. And the initial collaboration between nation states could then advance the ability to thwart extremist groups of all kinds being able to perpetrate what they perpetrate, because for that, you need the cooperation of the local law enforcement agencies in their country. And for that to happen, you can leverage other existing treaties and create new mechanisms of collaboration. When I say to you that I've witnessed it, I've seen it, where responsible parties in a particular country work with other responsible parties in a different country, and they normally, because they're professional in what they do, especially in the cyberspace, they work very well together. And I'm talking about not allies and friends, I'm talking about supposed adversaries. They work well because they're professional, and they're all human, and they all want good things to happen. So that I can to some extent rely on the goodwill of these, if you want to call it, decision makers who are not political, they're technical. They can do so, and law enforcement, they will do some good stuff. So I'm optimistic in that area. That's why my suggestion on what can be done as between nation states in terms of agreements, sort of treaties, but they're not treaties, memorandum of understanding, they could go far to diminish the risk and build some trust between those parties.
So in that case, for example, we would be talking like a group like Anonymous, who, let's say, at the moment, like they are hackers, but they are, let's say, the good hackers, they wouldn't be a cyber jihadist hacker group. right? They would become what, like a cyber Interpol?
No. You're missing the point here. Anonymous. Yeah, that's a very good point. Different people may label anonymous to be associated with one party or another. They're still a group. These treaties become structured and signed on by respective governments. Then those respective governments will then lean on groups that are associated with them. And this is how you then build trust on both sides. So whether it's the, let's leave it at that, because there are so many groups today that are operating as individuals and separate from governments, but they are working on the direction of many national security agencies. I won't go into more details, but at the end of the day, if the governments know about this, if Russia is talking to the US, Russia would tell the US, well, we know these people work on your behalf. The US will say, well, these people work on your behalf. They know these things. So they really can't just like shut a blind eye on the other side. Both sides know this stuff. It means there's going to be less BS being thrown, and that's where the opportunity for collaboration takes place. It takes some goodwill. Somebody has to make the initiative. But at the beginning, I said, Russia did propose a treaty on cyber in 2017 or 2018. My memory is going funky now. But we ignored it because we think we had the upper hand. And that's actually a fallacy, in my opinion, because you could be an inferior cyber nation, but you could cause severe damage and destruction on a superior nation.
So it doesn't matter if you have, let's say, a lesser cyber technology, like, because there were Dr. Jagat that was here, he was asking in the chat panel if Russia had more technology than us.
That's a good question, I would say, but I wouldn't want to go into who has more technology, who has less technology. You don't need to have the ultimate technology to cause damage to somebody or another nation state. The argument here is any nation that thinks it has superiority cannot think that it is immune. Because if these things are allowed to happen, the damage will be to people's lives and livelihood, critical national infrastructure, and the economic welfare of the nation states, businesses, and people. So the focus needs to be on no one is immune. Nobody, no one cannot be damaged, regardless of your technology. So this is where I think it needs to go, and this is where the argument I would make. One last point. I don't know if there's anybody else in the room. We've been now an hour and a half. I want to close the room and move forward so that we can all go to do our thing. If anybody wants to have, and I want to give a chance to one or two interventions. If anybody has a quick comment or a quick intervention they want to add that, please let us know. So that I give the floor before I'm the one who last spoke on this particular event. Gutta, do we have anybody who wants to add or shed any more light? If none, that's also fine.
Right. Let's go around the stage. Kay, would you like to say last remarks? William, Richard?
Gutta, please. One or two speakers, and please briefly. Because we need to move forward. Yeah, please go ahead.
Exactly. We have three there, and then Sam, and then you. Kay, would you like to say something?
Thank you for this room. Just short and sweet.
Okay, William. And Richard.
All these fancy rooms about Web3 and how trustworthiness is a part of Web3, I scoff at them because we can't even ascertain trustworthiness in this world, Web0 or 1 or 2. So this topic is so relevant. So thank you for stimulating our thinking. I return the mic.
All right, Sam. And then it's with you, Khaled, to, for us to close.
Well, first of all, thank you, Kay, for the thank you. And Richard, thank you for, if I feel I have stimulated one mind intellectually, that means my time has been well served. We all want the same thing. We all want to make sure that humanity is served, people's lives and livelihoods are preserved and protected. And if we can bring it down to that level, there's a lot of goodwill. We may disagree on style, we may disagree on things and that, but I think those of us who live in democratic societies, we have to have a much higher level of, if you want to call it, civic responsibility to hold our public officials accountable. I keep saying that all the time. I don't expect somebody who lives in a country where if he spoke out or she spoke out against their government or want to change, and may not necessarily see the morning, I don't expect them to be able to champion democracy and freedom. We can, because we live in a place we could speak freely, and it's our civic duty. In that sense, you know, I'm doing my part. Please spread the word, do your part as well, and let's hope we can make the world a better place.
Fantastic, guys. Thank you for joining us and to adding to the debate. Please follow the club, the Cyber War, Geopoly Cyber Warfare, right, in the greenhouse, the moderators, each other. Let's build as well a community around.